This is the Bat Pod.
Grab your bat microphone, it's time to start the show. Like a court of owls, the mystery is starting to grow. Let there be no debate, it's about to begin. Keen like Bruce Wayne, quick like Tim Drake, fierce like Damien. Grab your headphones, listen up, you know you love it. Drop the facade. Like the Dark Knight Detective, they've got some perspective. They're a pure crime-fighting collective. It's the Bat Pod.
Hello, and welcome to the Bat Pod. The first thing you've noticed is that I am not Bill Beer. This is Jay Loving. Bill is out this week. He has familial obligations. So it's just me, Jay Loving, joined by Martin Ferretti.
Yeah! Everyone get on Twitter and give Bill a shout-out. He needs some hugs right now.
Yes,
Bill,
he's having a little bit of a difficult time. So
yep. That's okay. The show must go on.
Yes, you will just get to hear a quite less professional version of the Bat Pod probably this time around.
It's very true, because I'm going to edit it, and I don't do what Bill does.
No, and you and I are notorious for not taking a whole lot of notes, if any, for.
I have notes. I have three tabs. Of episodes, Batman Animated Series episodes, so I remember the titles. Those are my notes.
Oh, okay. Well, that's pretty close to what I have as far as notes. So. But what we're going to be talking about this week are three books. We're going to be talking about Super Sons number 12, which is the end of that series, Detective 1006, and Batman Damned number 3.
Yeah! Now, so I know people are already wondering, why the hell are we talking about Super Sons? Let me just say that I will take full responsibility, because I wanted to talk about the Wildstorm number 24, but Jay wouldn't let me because it doesn't have Batman in it. So I picked Adventures of Super Sons number 12 as our third book because it has Damian Wayne in it. So it's Batman adjacent.
Yes. And I didn't say you couldn't do Wildstorm. I just pointed out it wasn't a Bat Family book. So.
Well, I'm glad we're not doing the Wildstorm, because I could probably talk about that book for like 2 hours.
It is a good series. There's no question about that.
It's a fantastic series. All right, so Super Sons number 12. This is written by Peter J. Tomasi, with pencils by Carlo Barberi, inks by Matt Santarelli, colors by Proto Bunker. That is the best name ever. I know that's not your real name, Proto Bunker, but props to you. Letters by Rob Lee, cover by Dan Mora, assistant editor Dave Wilgos, editor Paul Kaminsky, and group editor James S. Rich. So yes, as Jay, as you mentioned, this is the final episode or the final issue of this series. And I asked you a little bit beforehand how much you had read of this series, and I know you didn't read the whole thing, but you've read enough to be familiar with it. Yes. I have absolutely loved this series. I really enjoyed the first series that Peter Tomasi wrote, and I was really excited for this one. And spoilers, I'm really excited for the next one. Basically, the gist of it all is we figure out what the hell's been going on in this book. If you've been following along, there's been, I'm going to say, like, Batmite versions of various supervillains. We have Rex Luthor and Joker Jr. and a few others that show up in this series. And Damian and Jonathan have been fighting these guys all along. And in this issue, we figure out what was going on. And it turns out that the hypercube that Rex Luthor was trying to get control of in order to destroy reality and create his own is actually a living entity that originally created Rex Luthor and Joker Jr. and everybody else. And somehow they got out of this alternate reality into our reality, and now the hypercube has to make it right. And he does. And what I really liked about this issue is how meta it is. Because if you've been reading along, for the most part, it felt a lot like, I don't want to say typical, but a more typical YA type story with Jonathan and Damian. But, you know, with this issue, I think the book really goes in a different direction. Because we get this whole thing about the hypercube creating this reality, and you have realities within realities, and after the hypercube allows Jonathan and Damien to escape from this alternate dimension, he continues to create new realities within himself. You know, you see at the end there, there's like another Superman, and there's a like an adult Robin character who's extremely muscular, you know, things like that. And I thought that was cool because it really ties into the end of the book where you have these grown-ups kind of telling this story to children, and the kids are like, oh, you're just too lazy. That's why you're ending the story. And they're kind of like, no, the story always goes on forever. And I think that's really cool in terms of the way comics are written. Because, you know, sometimes people complain about books ending or going in directions that they don't like. But ultimately, you got to remember, these are just stories, and there's always going to be another story told that will maybe appeal to you.
I agree. What caught me about this, and I think I'm definitely going to go back and reread this series and read the whole series. One of the things that struck me, well, just last week, we talked about Golden Age comics.
Mm-hmm.
And the way this thing is written,
yes,
has a very Silver Age feel.
Yes.
I mean, the humor is kind of, it's a little bit silly in places. It makes you believe, you know, some things that happen. Deus Ex Machina, you know, just all of a sudden they pull things out of their hats to solve problems. But it's really satisfying, and it does a good job. I think Tomasi did a really excellent job on writing this.
Yeah, I thought it was great. I thought it was great. And you know what's interesting is I mentioned this being kind of more of a YA book. I'm almost 40, dude. You know what I'm saying? Like, if it appeals to me, then I think it can appeal to a lot of other people, right? And I think that's also something that we as comic fans forget sometimes. Just because a book is maybe billed as a YA book doesn't mean you can't get enjoyment out of it. You know, like Mike Myers always says, like, every book matters. Right? Because people always complain about, like, continuity changing and, like, reboots and this, that, and the other. But ultimately, you realize that, like, none of that really matters. And I know DC's addressing some of that with, like, Doomsday Clock, for example. But, you know, every story matters. And I think that's one of the messages in this particular book, or at least in this issue. And I thought that was really great. Yeah, I like there's a lot of nods to the Silver Age here as well. You know, in the Silver Age, we also had a lot of like doppelganger type characters that showed up.
Right.
Or like alternate reality versions of some characters, like Zebra Man. Did we talk about Zebra Man in our, character episode?
Don't think so.
Yeah, I don't think so. Matter of fact, I saw somebody tweeted at the Batpod today about Glass Man. And, you know, there's characters like that that just like, you know, they might be throwaways until somebody decides to make something cool out of them. And I think that's really important. And I like the message that Tomasi gives in this issue. So two thumbs up for me. I love this book.
Yes, it was quite good. I really enjoyed it. And a lot of interesting humor in there.
Yeah.
As we've said before, Tomasi does a great job of getting the personality of Damian Wayne,
mm-hmm.
the snarky teenager, is just down perfect. And there's one panel where it seems like Damian is always falling and Superboy is trying to catch him.
Yes.
And there's one printer where he's falling and he's like, okay, burning daylight here, you can catch me anytime. it's so Damian. I mean, it just catches his personality perfectly.
Yeah, very much so. Very much so. And I like that we learn also that, you know, in issue one, when issue one started, it's the last day of the school year. So they're just getting ready to celebrate like their summer of Superman or whatever, summer of super. That's what they call it. And apparently this series has taken, you know, the 3 months of summer, because when they finally escape the hypercube and they wake up in bed, Alfred comes to wake them up and he's like, all right, first day of school, boys. And they're like, what the hell? We've been gone all summer. We totally missed summer of super. So I thought that was fun as well.
It was.
Yeah.
Quite.
Yeah, it's very cool. I enjoyed it. And I like the art as well. I know the art maybe won't appeal to some folks. It's definitely very manga inspired, but I think it's great, and the colors are fantastic on it.
But I thought it fit for this story.
For sure.
The definite manga type
yep.
issues, especially with the characters like Rex Luthor. He just he didn't look anything. And the character, the alternate character that made me chuckle out loud was Doomsdame.
Yes.
So what a clever idea that came up.
Yeah, it's very cool. And I know that they tease kind of a feature story. That's obviously not been announced. And it might not be for a while for reasons. Because, Bendis has aged Jonathan Kent, for example. So to do another story within this time frame, it's definitely going to be kind of like a flashback type story. But I look forward to that.
I do too.
Yeah, I think it's cool.
Anything else on Super Sign?
No, loved it. Everyone should check this out.
Yes, you should. It's quite a good series.
Yep.
All right, we will move on to Detective Comics 1006. This is also written by Peter J. Tomasi, art by Kyle Hotz, colorist David Barron, letterer Rob Lee, assistant editor David Wyglass, group editor James Rich. And in this series, we start the beginning of a new arc. Two policemen, one named Jimmy Corrigan, are sitting there at a restaurant, and they get a call of a shooting in a back alley somewhere. And they find this victim who's kneeling with his head against the wall. Apparently, it was done in an execution-style slaying. There was no signs of struggle or any type of fight going on, just this executed character. And then suddenly, this group of, I don't know what to call them, demon-like characters are all hooded with pale skin, come pointing at them saying, the host must die, long live the host. They end up shooting one of the police officers before we have the appearance of Spectre, who comes in and breaks this up and totally obliterates one person. I mean, since pretty much explodes him and his remains go flying everywhere. And the scene then shifts to Batman, who's fighting a group of villains who had been doing some sort of a bank job. And then the Spectre appears to him 300 feet tall, but tells him that he needs the world's greatest detective's assistance. And what he's trying to find this Jim Corrigan, who has disappeared somehow. We see back before the fight ended that they injected him in the neck with some kind of serum. But he's unable to find this Jim Corrigan, and he wants Batman to help him locate him. And he takes him back to the crime scene where Gordon and the crime investigation squad are gathering evidence. And at first, he has them invisible to the Gordon. They can't see. Spectre tells Batman, "You don't understand the connection between Jim Corrigan and myself." And then he vaporizes, vanishes, and leaves Batman there. And then who talks with Gordon a little bit about the crime scene. He gathers evidence. And that's pretty much where the issue ends. Now, the interesting thing here is if you know a little bit about DC, the Spectre is a character from 1940. Jerry Siegel introduced the character. And the alter ego of the Spectre is police officer James Corrigan, who was murdered in one of the early editions of that comic. You still there, Martin?
I am. I'm listening.
Okay. Sorry. So if you know anything about that, you know that these two people are linked together. Batman is apparently, of course, unaware of that. And so we don't really know. Well, the issue ends with this group of villains that have captured Jim Corrigan and now have him laid out on a table with an IV in his arm. And they're still chanting that the spirit must die, long live the spirit. Mm-hmm. Or the host must die, long live the host. So,
yeah, I thought that was curious. I mean, to me, they look a lot like a group of specters, right? I mean, you don't really see much of their faces or anything, but you see the green cloaks. And I wonder, how much they're going to be changing the Spectre within this new iteration of DC. Because, you know, the Spectre has been, I mean, I don't want to say roughly the same, but he's been fairly consistent, I would say, over the past, oh man, I would say probably since the early 70s, right. The character's been fairly consistent. Now I do know that, at one point, there was another Spectre, so I'm wondering if, like, Tomasi's playing a little bit with that history of the character. Because, yeah, originally it was Jim Corrigan, and there's some ties to Eclipso, there's ties to, the Phantom Stranger, those kind of characters. And but Jim Corrigan's always kind of been there. And then when Rucka was doing Gotham Central, they kind of turned Jim Corrigan into a bad guy, and you thought that he was going to maybe turn into the Spectre, and then somebody else ends up becoming the Spectre, Crispus right. Allen. And that was really cool. So I'm wondering if he's playing a little bit with, like, the Spectre being, like, the spirit that takes possessions of hosts, and, you know, maybe at some point in the current iteration, Jim was a Spectre, but he's no longer the Spectre, right? That's why we still see the Spectre there, helping out Jim and his teammate when right. they're getting attacked by these guys. So I think that'd be kind of cool, actually.
Yeah, it's really interesting because at first, when the Spectre shows up, and I agree, those villains looked very much Spectre-ish. In fact, it was kind of confusing at first when the Spectre shows up.
Yeah.
While he was fighting against them, because, well, at first I thought they were disciples of the Spectre. But the thing I found curious is after they grabbed Corrigan and injected him with this serum, all of a sudden the Spectre says, "I can't feel your presence anymore," which leads me to believe he had some sort of psychological or telepathic link with Corrigan that was somehow now interrupted.
Well, and that's why I say maybe this is somebody else, like a different host of the Spectre. Because maybe the spirit that possesses the host still has a link to all the previous hosts. And if Jim was one of the previous Spectres, which is why he's getting attacked, and now he can no longer feel that presence, you know, maybe they just put him to sleep, right? It doesn't mean he's dead. Maybe they just anesthetized him so that the current spirit, the current Spectre, couldn't go and try to find him and save him. Right. Wow. Maybe there's some kind of ritual that they're about to do, to get the Spectre's body back into Jim, for example. I don't know yet. But it was pretty interesting.
It was quite a bit.
I really enjoyed the art as well in not the entire issue, but in many panels. It's got like a little resemblance to Breyfogel art. And I know you love Breyfogel, so I'm curious if you agree. But I thought that was interesting as well. In particular with the Spectre stuff, right? Because like Breyfogel always had, it was like bubbly muscularity, you know, and like ectoplasm type stuff around bodies sometimes when there was a lot of action. And I think there's a lot of that in this issue. So I thought that was pretty cool.
Well, I absolutely love the art. To me, that was the strongest part about this issue.
Yeah.
For me, as far as I know, I've not experienced the art of this Kyle Hotz before, but I quite agree. I saw elements of Breyfogel in there. I saw some elements of Kelly Jones in there as well.
Yeah, for sure. Yep.
And even some Bruce Timm. The way he drew Batman's ears on the cowl looked very much like Bruce Timm's, the way he drew the ears on in the Batman the Animated Series.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I mean, the thing I noticed that he did that I thought was very satisfying was Batman's cape. He drew Batman's cape so long, flowing, and so long. I mean, it would, from a practical standpoint, it would be absolutely in the way. I mean, it's like it'd be a pain in the neck. But you know, but the way he did that was just, it really painted Batman as a menacing character. I adored the art.
Well, yeah, that's where the Kelly Jones inspiration comes from, right? Because Kelly used to do that too. The super long cape with, you know, 3,000 folds in the cape.
Yeah,
nobody else does that.
Exactly. So yeah, that's all. It looked like influences of several artists in the artwork.
That might explain why we both really enjoyed it. A lot of callbacks.
Plus, it was a good story. I thought it was set up a... I'm interested to find out what happens.
For sure. For sure. And I do hope they bring in some of these other characters like Eclipso and Phantom... I love Phantom Stranger. I think Phantom Stranger is one of the most underutilized DC characters because most people can't write the Phantom Stranger properly. The only one that wrote him properly was, what's the guy that, Dan Didio, the current co-publisher. He wrote the New 52 series, and I thought that was fantastic. But aside from that, like, nobody else really knows how to write him. Because, you know, Phantom Stranger is from, like, a specific era of history. And, sometimes those characters don't translate very well. You know, when you bring in, like, deep cut golden age characters into modern era, they don't always work out very well. I think a few of them have, like Spectre, I think is one of them. I think Etrigan is one of them. But outside of that, like it's been kind of tough for some of these guys. And you know, there's plenty of DC characters from the 40s and 50s, or even like Charlton characters that they bought out that, there's no way they could ever do now because they're just terrible or, you know, just have like terrible names. That's why I'm surprised, like, Shang-Chi over at Marvel, like, is still somewhat relevant, and they're making a movie. Because that's one of those characters, you know what I mean?
I do, yes.
Very good. Yeah, I enjoy this quite a bit. I'm looking forward to see how the arc plays out.
Yes, I am too.
And again, this to me feels like a more traditional Batman book than the main Batman book, right? They're both very different.
Yes. I would say yes, it's definitely more traditional. If you look at its 80-year history, yeah, it's more of a traditional story.
Yep, for sure.
All right, then. Well, we will move on to our topic of the week, which is the top three Batman the Animated Series episodes.
The answer is all of them.
It is so good. I even after it's, what, been 25 years now?
Yeah. More than that, I think, yeah.
Yeah, it's... And everything is just absolutely, nothing seems dated on it. The animation is just, it's a superb series. It's just an absolutely superb series.
Agreed. And as I told you previously, I spent the last 5 hours watching Batman the Animated Series just so I can make sure that I picked out three really good episodes. And I hope I did.
I'm sure you did. Why don't you go ahead and give us your number three?
Man, that's tough. See, are we going order? Crap. All right. Number three, I'm going to go with, for a long time, this was my number one. But upon rewatching it, I think, there's two episodes that beat it out for me right now. So I'm placing it at number three. And that is Heart of Ice. It's, episode 14 from season one, released on September 7th, 1992. I don't think that's correct, DC, but that's what DC Universe tells me. I'm pretty sure it came out before that. Anyways, this is the story of Mr. Freeze, a character that I think we both really enjoy, and it's a very tragic episode. Grammy Award-winning, by the way, episode. One of the first animated shows to receive a Grammy, in particular for this episode. So that's very cool. And, it follows the story of Mr. Freeze, how he became Mr. Freeze, the plan that he has to get revenge on the person he blames for his wife dying. And, it's got a very tragic beginning and a really heartbreaking ending. And what's really cool about it is that Batman realizes that even though this guy's a villain, like, what he's doing is he's doing it for a good cause. And so eventually, ultimately, he's the one that is able to get revenge for the wrongs done on Mr. Freeze. He's the one that finds the evidence to take down the CEO of Goth Corp, who was responsible for Nora Freeze dying. So I thought that was very cool. Yeah, it's a fantastic episode.
It is. My number three... This may kind of surprise you because it's not one of the more, I guess, dramatic episodes, but it's Almost Got Him or Almost Got Him.
Oh, yeah, that's a good one. Say. Yeah, yeah.
And in this episode, the Penguin, the Joker, Two-Face, Poison Ivy, and Killer Croc are kind of hiding out from the police and they're playing poker. And they're all giving their stories of the time they almost got the Batman. And it's just, it's kind of a lighter hearted and a lot of funny humor in that, especially for the Joker. You know, you see again, Mark Hamill's brilliant, absolutely brilliant rendition of the Joker. And it just, I don't know, it was a good series, I guess, a good episode.
Yeah, that's got, it's like five vignettes, right? Like they each recount their best encounters with Batman. Yeah, that's a good one.
All except Killer Croc. They didn't recount his. He just said Batman was coming at him and he threw a rock at him. And then they all looked at him like, that's the best you've got.
Well, I think,
well, it was a really big rock.
I think Killer Croc was only one or two other episodes. Right. Like he was only the central villain in one episode, and then like the rest of them were just cameos, like in this episode. Really? So that kind of explains why. I like this episode a lot actually, and it reminds me of a few other ones. So there's one. It's not a Batman animated series episode. It's a comic book issue. And I can't remember which one it is, but it's about like five different people that like recount their meeting with Batman, and. There's some like really cool stories in there. You know what I'm talking about? Like some people see them as a complete villain, some see him as a complete hero, and then there's like shades of gray in between. I'll have to go back to my library and see what issue that was. But that's a really good one, and it's kind of the same thing, right? Told from the Gothamites point of view. Man, you know that's what we need. We need that kind of series. What book was that? Was that Legends of the Dark Knight that did that?
I don't recall. Man. I know which one you're talking about, but I cannot recall the title.
There was one that was more like street level. And I'm not talking about Gotham Central before anybody says that. There was one that was more street level and barely had Batman in it. I mean, obviously Batman's in it because it's a Batman book. But, man, I want to say it was Legends. Or maybe it was like early Shadow of the Bat. Anyway, it doesn't matter. I'll find the episode. If I find it before I put the episode out, I'll put it in the show notes.
Okay.
All right, I guess that means my number two, eh?
Yes.
My number two is Beware the Grey Ghost. It's episode 18, released November 4th, 1992. And this is a fantastic episode. There's a criminal on the loose in Gotham that is blowing buildings up. And he promises he's going to quit blowing stuff up if Gotham pays him $1 million. Which I guess in 92, $1 million was a lot, eh? Because I don't know.
Yeah, not unlike today.
Yeah, unlike today. Amelia's like, hey, whatever. Let me just pull it out of my wallet. Not really. Nobody says that. So Batman has to figure out who this guy is, and he starts seeing similarities to like so he remembers it being similar to something else. And one night he's having a dream, and he dreams about the Grey Ghost. He recalls watching the Grey Ghost when he was a kid, and his dad kind of making him go to bed after the Grey Ghost was finished, and of course the Grey Ghost is kind of a little bit like a mix of the Shadow and Zorro, which are kind of the two inspirations for Batman, and I think that's really why I enjoyed this episode so much. Well, one of the reasons is actually another one that I'll get to in a second, because. Like, the story's great, the progression Batman's detecting of, like, how to figure out this puzzle, how to figure out who the villain is really interesting, but I like the fact that they do a lot of nods to the inspirations for Batman in a very meta way, right? Because you have Batman himself discussing his inspirations for being a kid, and there's some really cool emotional moments. In particular, towards the end, when he actually meets the actor that played the Grey Ghost, who, by the way, is voiced by Adam West, which is another reason I really love this, because it's meta upon meta. And right. And the story of the Grey Ghost is very similar to the real-life story of Adam West, where the Grey Ghost in the TV show, he's dead broke. He lives in a slum apartment building. He's behind on rent. And, you know, he still has a lot of his Grey Ghost memorabilia around the house. But he's broke. He has an agent, but nobody will hire him because everyone just remembers him as the Grey Ghost, and they just want him to make appearances as the Grey Ghost. And that's very similar to how Adam West was, you know, after he did the Batman 66. Like, if you look at his IMDb page, he's done a lot of stuff. Don't get me wrong. Like, the guy has not been out of work, But he hasn't done like anything huge. I would say, and really no big recurring roles until he started doing Family Guy in 2000. I think he plays the mayor in Family Guy. So he's been in a bunch of episodes, like 100 plus episodes. But before that, it's like an episode or two of a particular series, or like a made for TV movie, or like appearing somewhere as Adam West, or, you know, like recapping his role as Batman in like the late 70s, for example. So the stories, I think, between the characters are very similar, and it's a very tragic story. But it's also redeemed, because at the end, he decides to wear the costume of the Grey Ghost and actually helps Batman figure out who is bombing the city and ends up capturing him. And at the end, he's on, like, I think it was Time Magazine, like on the cover of Time Magazine, and they end up releasing on, I guess it was cassette tape back then, VHS, the entire series of The Grey Ghost, because the studio that made it apparently burnt down 20 years prior to the story, so nobody had recordings of this TV show. In fact, the only person that had recordings of the show was the guy that played The Grey Ghost. So after he became famous for helping Batman, they released the thing and his career resurged. And I thought that was very cool. And at the end, Bruce Wayne shows up to a signing of the release of the DVDs or the VHSs. And, he's like, make it up to Bruce. He's like, okay, Bruce. And he signs it. And Bruce is like, you know, I used to watch The Grey Ghost with my dad when I was young. You were my hero back then. You're still my hero. And The Grey Ghost realizes that that's Batman, because when they catch the villain, that's the same exact, wording that he gives to The Grey Ghost. So that was kind of cool to see as well. I love this episode. It's fantastic.
Pretty good. Yeah, it was a good one. I enjoyed that one. My number two is I Am the Knight. And this is an episode where Batman, Bruce, is starting to question his mission. You know, how much good has he really done? You know, is he causing more problems than he's solving? In other words, by being Batman, is he bringing out more villains? And it kind of centers around, in this story, he's going out and he's going to take, it's just the annual thing he does on the death anniversary of his parents' death. He takes two roses to Crime Alley and lays them down on the sidewalk. And he meets Leslie Tompkins there. And so he's late showing up for a police raid that Gordon, they've been tracking this character, Jazzman, a smuggling ring for some time, and they're going to go in and do a bust and arrest them. Well, it turns out it's a setup. They were lured in because Jazzman has a vendetta against Gordon, who put him in jail 6 years previously, and he's got this high-powered rifle that he's going to use to shoot Gordon. Well, Batman shows up after the firefight has started, and he eventually, of course, puts the villains down. Jazzman is apprehended, but Gordon is wounded. Severely wounded, and then hospital, comatose. And so Batman is really blames himself. If he'd been there 5 minutes earlier, if he hadn't stopped by Crime Alley, then he would have been there. And he's really starting to question his, role. In fact, he takes off his cowl and throws it down a chasm that's in the Batcave and pretty much decides not to be Batman. Well, Jazzman escapes, of course, and he's going to go after Gordon. And, you know, Dick is trying to convince him he's got to come back, and because Jazzman will attempt and succeed to kill Gordon. And of course, in the end, things redeem. But it's a very good episode, because it's one of the points where we see Bruce, Batman, start to have a little bit of a crisis in confidence, a little bit question himself. Is what I'm doing the correct thing to do? Am I making any progress? Am I doing any good? And it's just a really, I thought, well done, well acted out episode.
Very good. Yeah, I think that maybe kind of goes along with my number one pick, which is going to be Perchance to Dream, episode 30 from October 19th, 1992. And, you know, I think Bruce is very sure at this point that Batman is what he wants to be. But he's thrown on kind of around the loop, because he's no longer Batman. He wakes up and he leads a very normal life. Bruce and Martha Wayne are still alive. They were never killed. In fact, Thomas, did I say Bruce and Martha? I meant Thomas and Martha. Thomas has just retired, so Bruce is the CEO of Wayne Corp. And our Wayne Enterprises, he is engaged to Selina Kyle. They're getting ready to get married. And Bruce is very confused because he's not Batman and his parents are alive and he's engaged to Catwoman and he has no idea what's happening. In fact, it gets even worse when he's talking to Selina and Batman like swings by and he's like, what the hell? Who's Batman? And Selina's like, nobody knows who Batman is. Like, he just showed up. And he's like, that doesn't make any sense. So he starts like researching and he's like reading newspapers and books and nothing makes sense. He like he can't read anything properly. So he kind of starts tumbling, right? Like his mind starts tumbling. He's going a little crazy trying to figure out what's going on. And so one night he decides to go to the bell tower that he usually begins his prowling every night at. And while he's there, this new Batman shows up. And he's like, I knew you would come here because I always start my watch at this tower. And, you know, they have a little conversation. Batman is kind of like, look, Bruce, I don't know what the hell you think's going on here. But you need to, you know, go back to your fiance and your parents before you get hurt. Like, the cops are outside trying to find Bruce because, like, they saw him climb the tower by a rope. And so they think he's going up there to kill himself. And so there's cops all over the place. And Bruce Wayne and Batman start fighting it out. And they have a really interesting conversation that I can't really recap, but I recommend anyone watch this episode to hear it. Because in many ways, it reminds me a little bit of what we've been talking about with the current Tom King Batman run. And a little bit of what we talked about when we talked about Last Night on Earth. How much of this is a dream and how much of it real? As it turns out, the villain of the episode, you don't even see him till literally the last 60 seconds, is the Mad Hatter. And, you know, the Mad Hatter always has, like, very kooky things to say, but they make sense, philosophically, I guess. So he's like, well, like, are you in your own dream or are you living somebody else's dream? And, you know, he tries to punch Mad Hatter, and of course doesn't hurt him. He's like, I'm a dream. You can't hurt me. It's like, just do what you're supposed to, Bruce. Go back to your life, and you know you won't get hurt. And you know, Bruce, being as stubborn and as strong-minded as he is, he decides that the only way to break out of this, he's like, I know this is a dream because when I try to read the newspaper and those books, like, I couldn't read them. Because you dream with your left side of your brain and you read with the right side of your brain. So I knew it was a dream. He's like, and I know how to escape it. So he jumps off the tower. And of course, you can't die in your dreams. So right when he lands, he wakes up and he's been kidnapped by the real life Mad Hatter. And who can't believe that he was able to escape this machine nightmare that he had created for Bruce. And he ends up putting him away. But it's really cool the way it's done. I know that they've done a few of these kind of stories before in the past. I believe there is I want to say it was Detective Comics, but I know it's not Detective Comics. There's a story in the 70s that's basically exactly this story without the involvement of the Mad Hatter, but where Bruce's parents haven't died and he does marry Selina and all this stuff. Kathy Kane's the one that ends up becoming Batman. She's not just Batwoman. She like literally becomes Batman. I mean, they call her Batwoman, but she looks right. More like Batman. And so it's got a lot of similarities to that story. But this is one of my favorite episodes. I like a lot of the mind play in this. In some ways, it reminds me a little bit. I don't know if you've ever seen the episode with the Clock King.
Yes.
There's some similarities at the end. Like, the Clock King episode is great, but like that final fight when they're fighting on the clock and everything's like twisting and like upside down and like morphing into other things, it reminds me a lot of this episode. And I love that kind of stuff. So, yeah. Perchance to Dream. Fantastic episode.
Very good. Well, my number one, unlike you, I think for a long time, Heart of Ice was my number one. Just there's probably not a better, just more better crafted episode. But what I put as number one was Feet of Clay.
Yes.
And this one, it's a two-part episode, actually. And at the beginning of this, Bruce Wayne is being framed for the murder of Lucius Fox. But the real perpetrator is an actor named Matt Hagen, who was disfigured in a car accident some years earlier. But in order to keep his fame and keep working, he started working for this underworld character, Ronald Daggett, who provides him with this supply of this special face cream called Renew You that temporarily reshapes your face back to normal so he can keep his acting job. Well, this Daggett wants to take over Wayne Enterprises for marketing expansion. But anyway, because of his botching his murder of not being able to kill Lucius Fox, Hagen cuts off his supply of this face cream. And Hagen breaks into Daggett's lab, but his men, Daggett's henchmen catch him and then literally just drench his face in this formula. And he ends up swallowing a bunch of it before apparently drowning. And in the second part of this, second episode, Wayne is released from prison on bail, but Hagen now, because of his exposure to this, a massive amount of this stuff, has entered his body and changed all of his cells. So he's turning him into this shape-shifting mutant known as Clayface. And he ends up going on, decides to try to take his revenge out on Daggett. But a lot of innocent people are being, you know, put in harm's way. And then Batman has to try to bring Daggett to justice. Other than that, you know, the overall story, this is another very kind of emotional. It's similar to Victor Freeze in the fact that you kind of feel empathy for this character, this Hagen. You know, all he wanted to do was keep his job as an actor, you know. And in acting, yeah, your face, your looks, that's paramount.
Yeah. And
that's all he wanted to do was, you know, to keep his fame and to keep his job. And then he becomes this kind of tragic, sympathetic character of Clayface. And actually, I thought it was a well done episode. Well done.
That's a two-parter, right?
Yeah, two-parter. Yeah, starring by Marv Wolfman, actually, on that, too.
Yeah, that's a really good one. I think you kind of hit it on the head, though. I think what makes a lot of these Batman Animated Series episodes so good is how human the villains are, right? Because a lot of times when you read the comics, like, you don't really see that, right? You see the plot and then Batman figuring out the plot and taking the villain down. Not always, but a lot of times you do see that. And I think with the animated series, like, every single villain was, like, a genuine person. Even to some extent, the Joker had a little bit of that. One of the ones that I almost picked for this, but it's going to be a little bit lower down, maybe like top five, was Pretty Poison, the Poison Ivy episode. That I think that has a lot of similarities to this one as well, because you do see like how broken she is, you know what I mean? And you definitely see that with this Feet of Clay episode. Very good.
And another one that, in that same vein is the episode, it's another two-part episode, Two-Face.
Mm-hmm.
Which I think is the best telling outside of the comic books, as far as the best telling of the story, origin of Two-Face. You know, who also, but again, a very sympathetic character who's, you have some empathy for.
Yep. Yeah, you should do, if you're listening and you don't want to watch a Two-Face two-parter, you should watch Pretty Poison first, because Harvey Dent plays a key role in that because he's engaged to Poison Ivy.
Yes. Yep. She actually mentions that in that episode.
That's right.
I'm talking about Almost Got Him. She goes, yeah, we used to date.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Very good. Let's go to our last book.
Yes. The last book. Batman Damned, number 3.
Yes. we're going to tackle this one together. So written by Azzarello with art by Lee Bermejo. We have letters by Jared Fletcher, because Lee does everything. It's fully painted, and it is absolutely beautiful. I would say one of the best looking books that DC has put out in decades.
I would agree.
Decades. The story, though, not as clean and clear, I would say.
That would be, in my opinion, an understatement.
yes.
And I'm a big fan of Azzarello too. I'm not, you know, saying that, but this, yeah.
Yeah. So this book has had a lot of problems, right? There was a lot of controversy with issue one. There were delays with issue two. There were delays with issue three. Maybe some of the story that wanted to be placed in here was not what we actually saw in the final pages. I know Warner Brothers made some changes to the story. I know Azzarello was not very happy with that, and I was very clear about not being happy with it. So I do wonder if we had received the full original story, would this have read a little bit better? However, I will also say that if you want to read this, you should probably read all three at once.
Yes.
Because reading these monthly, and even if you were picking them up on the shelf when they were coming out late, it would make it very difficult to remember what happened with the previous issue.
Yes, and I mean, I went back and I reread all three of them today.
Yeah.
In fact, and I still, I can't say for sure what this story is about. I really can't.
Yeah, so I think we should maybe start there. Jay, what's the story about?
It's all right. Batman is definitely undergoing some of his own internal demons here. I get that from the get-go.
Yes.
But, you know, and in the first issue, John Constantine shows up, who's sort of his, I don't know how you call it, not the overriding narrator of the story, but he's sort of...
Well, he is narrating the story.
He is, and he's kind of like, I don't know.
He's like the ghost of Christmas past.
Yeah, or I was thinking more like, you know, Homer in was to in the...
The Odyssey?
The Inferno. No, Dante's Inferno.
Oh, okay, okay.
Because Homer was guiding, you know, him was the guy. Sort of like that kind of made me a little bit thinking is sort of, all right, you're sort of guiding him through this story. But, you know, I mean, we see all these macabre images. The Joker has supposedly been killed. Batman doesn't believe it. It's just, I don't know.
Yeah, it's very curious. So, I mean, ultimately what I assume of this story is that maybe Enchantress has put some kind of spell on Batman to make him believe that the Joker's been killed, though in reality he hasn't. And maybe some of that has to do, I think a lot of it has to do with like mental disability. It's not the right word. It's not the right word. Mental illness. There you go.
Right.
Where you do wonder how sane Batman is. As you're going through this book, because you do see a lot of weird stuff, right? A lot of the magical side of DC shows up. Like this issue has, it's Constantine, you got Swamp Thing, Zatanna shows up looking beautiful. I may have a little crush on Zatanna. I know I don't talk about that a lot, but maybe I do. But Zatanna shows up. Enchantress has been there the whole time. You know, when in issue one, she's like a young, beautiful Enchantress. By this issue, she's almost like a rotting corpse. And I mean, I guess that's what's happening, right? Like, she's taking Batman on this weird psychological journey to figure out who he is and why he is the way he is. And maybe that's what the explanation for the outcome with the Joker is, because there's some very obvious references to the Killing Joke in this particular issue.
Absolutely.
In fact, several panels are directly from the Killing Joke. So I'm curious, like, what Azzarello's trying to call back to here, right? Like, is he saying that Batman was kind of lost for a while and, like, from the period after Killing Joke until he wrote this book, like, none of that matters. Because ultimately, like, what really matters is the relationship between the Joker and Batman. I mean, I don't know. You know, they wrote that Joker book together.
Right.
So I wonder if maybe before reading Batman Damned, it might be worth reading Azzarello's Joker book.
I hadn't thought about that, but that's a good thought.
Because, you know, they're doing that with Snyder, right? Like, Snyder's doing Last Night on Earth, which is a continuation of his run in New 52.
Right.
So maybe that's what this is. Maybe it's a continuation of him and Bermejo's Joker story.
That's very good. I hadn't even thought about that. That's clever. You may have me onto something there.
I mean, maybe. And I haven't read that since it came out, so I remember nothing from that book.
Yeah, it's been too many years for me as well. But, yeah, I mean, I think that's probably as close to understanding what the story is about. It just, yeah, Batman is undergoing some definitely mental trauma here. And the one thing I didn't, that kind of most disappointed me about this third episode was right towards the end, we go back to the murder of his parents. And I know that's a defining moment for Bruce Wayne. I know that's what set him off, but it's like, okay, I think it's overused in a lot of ways. Mm. It's like, okay, everybody knows this part of the story, and I'm not sure how that fit in. It seemed a little like it was shoehorned in a little bit into the story.
Yeah, I think the only time it makes sense to directly show that scene is if you're actually doing something different with it, right? But it seems like every time we see it, they're not really doing anything different with it. They're just like, hey, this is why he's Batman. All right, yes, we know. But, like, why does it matter to your story? You know what I mean?
Right.
I mean, and like I said, Entrenchus is trying to show him something, right? She's even, when he's reliving that scene, she's holding him with his parents dead on the ground. By the way, beautiful page.
Oh, yeah, absolutely gorgeous.
But look, why?
Yeah, it really doesn't explain it.
It doesn't. And then at the end, I'm wondering, like, did she change how he remembers when he killed the Joker? Because the Joker's not dead, right?
Right. I don't know. Could be. Very well could be. But, yeah, I don't know. I didn't read it as a completely confusing or bad story. It just didn't seem to be as coherent as it could have been.
Yeah.
And maybe it was because of the delays and changes. I don't know.
I don't know, man. But I mean, you read it all back to back again. I also read the three issues back to back. So maybe we both missed something.
And maybe it's one of those that you're not really supposed to get a meaning out of. I mean, I don't know.
Sure.
But I agree with what you say. I mean, it's from the artwork and the presentation, this is a gorgeous book. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's absolutely one of the best visually appealing, aesthetically appealing things DC has done in a long time.
Mm-hmm.
So if you like the artwork, it may just be worth it just for that.
Very possible. I don't know. We'll see. I might pick doing a trade of this. I'm sure they will. I might pick it up if they put it on trade.
Yes.
Even though I have the issues. I think that's it, though. Are we done?
I believe we're done, yes.
Wow, amazing.
Yes, very short episode of the Bat Pond.
Well, I mean, it's an hour, so that's not that short.
Well, not that short, but compared to our last one, yeah, it is short. So.
That's true. All right, take us out, then.
And I was very remiss. I didn't get the email. I know there's an email for the podcast, and I don't know what it is, so maybe we can look that up and put it in the show notes. My apologies for that. But you've been listening to another episode of the Bat Pod. Bill will be back next episode. Martin will not be. You will be taking a sabbatical from podcasting for the next month or
Correct.
So.
Yes, sir.
And we should have Ronnie Barron joining us. So we'll see you next time. Same bat time, same bat channel.